for individuals interested in the medical field. Welcome to the Doc Talk Podcast, where doctors from around the world discuss groundbreaking work in the medical industry. Because in an ever-changing world, healthcare is constant.
Happy spring to listeners tuning in. Our guest speaker today is the clinical director of the Fatty Liver Disease Program and assistant professor of medicine at the Yale School of Medicine, Dr. Albert Doe. Dr. Albert Doe completed his undergraduate studies with a bachelor's degree in molecular and cell biology and psychology at the University of California at Berkeley, and a medical doctorate and master's in public health epidemiology at Boston University. He completed his residency and fellowship training at Yale University and has expertise and interest in gastroenterology, hepatology, obesity medicine, and metabolic health. He's particularly interested in all forms of fatty liver disease, including non-alcoholic fatty liver disease and associated obesity, as well as alcohol-associated fatty liver disease, which are significant public health problems. Being board certified in obesity medicine and lifestyle medicine further informs his interests and skills of metabolic health. I am so grateful for your time. It is truly appreciated, Dr. Doe, and your work is extremely timely. I would love to dig into it a bit further.
So it's a pleasure.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. So most of our listeners are, it's like the general public and pre-med students. Pre-med students might know this, but for the general public, can you tell me what exactly is a hepatologist and what kind of work do they do? What kind of training does one do to become a hepatologist?
Sure. And again, thank you for the pleasure of speaking with you and to your audience. So a hepatologist is a specialist physician who cares for patients with liver diseases. They specialize in assessing those who have abnormal liver tests or have abnormal findings on imaging tests of their liver or have clinical symptoms or signs suggesting that they have liver diseases, including what was commonly known as cirrhosis. And that's a broad set of things, which I'm sure we'll end up talking during the course of this conversation. But to become a hepatologist, one generally goes to college or university, and that generally takes 4 years. And then they go to medical school thereafter to become a physician, which is 4 years. They then generally complete an internal medicine residency here in the States, which takes 3 years. And then generally a fellowship in gastroenterology, which is 3 years after that. And some people thereafter start a practice in general hepatology, but some people do an extra year of training if they want to practice in what's called transplant hepatology, providing medical care for patients to get them through and then after receiving a liver transplantation. So then that's another 1 year after that. For my part, I've completed the gastroenterology fellowship portion, and then I started practice after that. So a total of after medical school, 6 more years of training after that, in short.
I see. That's great. Yeah, I want to go into neurology, which is neurosurgery, which is like 7, maybe 8 years of residency. So we love school.
ultimately for all fields, it ends up being what we call lifelong learning. So certainly, you know, excel for that.
I mean, if you enjoy the journey, it's great. So that's great. But yeah, so I think you're probably an academic hepatologist. So can you describe what a typical week looks like for you and the work that you do exactly?
Sure. Yeah. Most hepatologists end up being work to some degree in academics, so that's not necessarily the case for everyone, and it's by virtue of hepatology generally being transplant in practice to some degree, and that usually ends up being a team sport, which requires sort of a multiple specialists sort of working together, and that usually ends up being in the context of being in an academic medical center. But in terms of my practice, and everyone's practice differs to some degree, but in terms of academics, that ends up being a combination of sort of all types of practices. And for mine, it ends up being mostly a clinic-based practice. Number one, being mostly in the clinic, I see patients in my clinic, which is for fatty liver diseases, which we'll talk about in a bit, I'm sure. But I also spend several weeks out of the year seeing patients who are hospitalized, and that ends up being patients who are under my care, under our liver inpatient service, but then also a few weeks in our liver consult service, whereby other services would ask for our help in consultation for a variety of liver issues, whereas they're hospitalized for another primary issues. But as liver issues come up, we're asked to sort of provide sort of consultative help. And then I also, by virtue of being a gastroenterologist, sort of perform endoscopic procedures on patients also. So a day out of the week, you know, in our outpatient endoscopy center, I perform endoscopic procedures on patients as well, upper endoscopies, colonoscopies, and sort of associated interventions on patients as well. And you know, being in academics, then, you know, part of my time is spent on academic work. And that means a variety of things. And it's different from person to person, depending on their interests. But for me, you know, that means spending a proportion of time teaching, building our clinical fatty liver disease program. And that means trying to grow the program, outreach to other providers, other physicians, and other staff, but also research as well. And so that means planning for research, having research meetings, thinking about writing manuscripts and applying for grants, attending conferences and giving talks and lectures to those in our institution and sort of regionally, nationally, internationally as well, but a variety of academic work as well, in addition to sort of the patient care activities that we have. So on top of that, I guess I'll say I have three young kids, and my wife is a physician as well in academics. So all in all, I'll say it's a very exciting life. I'll say I'm never bored.
Yeah, that's actually so good to hear, because every time I speak to like a physician, they'll probably like discourage me from like from getting into medicine, mainly because I'm a woman and I should probably, you know, having a family and having a family life is difficult. And that's just how it is. 90% of the time, like most of the doctors I've shadowed are like that. So it's really nice to hear that you have as a physician, have a great work-life balance. I think it's so important with like physician burnout. So that sounds super exciting. And I totally love your work. And you spoke a little bit about the interventions that you do in the fatty liver disease program. Can you talk about the clinical tools that you use in diagnosing liver diseases, especially like in the differential diagnosis when it's like not a cirrhosis and it's probably something else? What kind of tools do you use in that diagnosing process?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you know, a hepatologist's tools probably don't differ too much from that of another physician, but you know, each discipline probably has their own sort of flavor, take on the traditional tools that we use as physicians. But a hepatologist would, number one, rely on clinical history and the physical examination when one does have advanced liver disease, cirrhosis in particular, that there are certain clues that we look for, because the majority of patients are asymptomatic, but we rely on a clinical history and a physical examination to find clues of liver disease to begin with. We also utilize laboratory tests, you know, blood tests, urine tests, et cetera. We look at numbers, and I'll say that, you know, there are some other fields, and liver is one of them, whereby sort of looking at numbers is sort of a heavy part of what we do. A lot of the story of the liver is told through numbers. And so laboratory tests, we do lean heavily on in this field. Imaging tests, we look at commonly, and the liver is a large organ, and we can see it very well on a variety of imaging tests, ultrasounds, magnetic resonance imaging or MRI or computed tomography, CT imaging as well, but a variety of other imaging tests that we have available. And then we can also obtain liver biopsy samples. We can sort of pass a needle through into the liver and obtain a biopsy sample, look at it under the microscope, and with the help of our pathology colleagues, we're able to glean a lot of information looking at the biopsy under the microscope as well. And that tells us a lot of information of what's going on. If there's some sort of lesion or mass in the liver, we can biopsy such lesions as well and learn a lot about that also. And again, being a gastroenterologist, you know, there's a lot of interplay between things that you can see under the camera on endoscopy as a consequence of liver disease. And so then, you know, as a gastroenterologist, we perform endoscopic procedures as well on patients with liver disease related to their liver care also. So endoscopy, upper endoscopy, colonoscopy, the associated interventions of those procedures as part of the diagnosis and treatments for patients with liver disease as well. So that probably summarizes the variety of tools that we generally use. But you know, I'd say like hepatology as a field probably is a numbers and pictures heavy type of field compared to sort of other medicine type fields, if you had to sort of put us into a bucket.
I see. That's very interesting. And, you know, I've always heard this, and I think it's a reputation for like the liver being the most selfless organ, as opposed to the brain, which it consumes like 20% of all your body's energy. So you, like I mentioned, when I was introducing you, you're like the director of the fatty liver disease program, and I was hoping we could go more in depth with that. So what kind of things cause like fatty liver disease in general? And if you could just provide more insight into your expertise pertaining to that, that would be excellent.
Sure. Yeah. So you know, fatty liver disease is a broad term, and it's a disease that's sort of near and dear to my heart, just because it's of particular public health importance for one such as myself, who kind of has an eye towards diseases that are slated to or are thought to and are expected to affect a large number of people throughout the world. You know, it's thought that this disease is the most common chronic liver disease in the world at this point. And the reason is because the causes of this disease are so common. So starting from the beginning, you know, fatty liver diseases describe a variety of diseases whereby for one reason or another, excess fat builds up inside the liver. Normally the liver encounters fat in the blood, but it can clear the fat that it encounters pretty readily. But for a variety of reasons, fat can build up inside the liver. And in most people, the fat generally, you know, even when the fat builds up inside the liver, the fat doesn't do much. But in some people, the fat inside the liver causes inflammation inside the liver. And chronic inflammation inside the liver, generally speaking, is what defines a chronic liver disease. And the issue with that is that chronic liver inflammation is chronic liver injury, and that can lead to chronic liver damage. So scarring, also known as fibrosis of the liver, can develop and become severe. And in the long term, severe liver scarring is also known as cirrhosis. And that is what causes issues in the long term in anyone with any chronic liver disease. So fatty liver disease can cause cirrhosis, long-term damage of the liver, and can cause all the complications of cirrhosis, which we sort of think about, jaundice and other associated complications. But fat buildup in the liver is most commonly caused by, number one, metabolic factors. So excess weight, obesity, and related to that, diabetes, what we call non-alcoholic fatty liver disease or metabolic associated fatty liver disease. Or number two, unhealthy alcohol use. So alcohol causes fatty liver disease also. And so between metabolic factors or obesity related fatty liver disease and alcohol, we have two sort of diseases of modern society that both cause fatty liver disease, which are both in and of themselves public health issues to begin with, which then both result in liver disease. And so these diseases are already public health issues, but in turn will then lead to a liver-related public health issue. And so on top of that, then fatty liver disease can be caused by a variety of other lesser common things, but certain medications, certain diseases of pregnancy, and other things which are sort of less common. But suffice it to say, there are a variety of things that cause fatty liver disease that we want to get to the bottom of and ultimately treat.
Okay, yeah, that's very insightful. Thank you. I feel like the current generation is so used to popping pills, we don't necessarily know the impact that it's having on our body. For example, I just recently read an article about how common drugs like acetaminophen, which is Tylenol, can negatively impact the liver. I'll put the link to that article in the episode description, but this seemed very relevant. Are there any other types of medication that can impact the liver, and why does this happen?
Yeah, so yeah, you touch upon a concept that sort of us as hepatologists is a bit of the bane of our existence, which is this disease state called drug-induced liver injury. You know, it's known that any drug we take, you know, the idea is that when you take a medication, any supplement, or when you eat something, right, like you absorb said substance into your blood and then it goes into your body. That's the act of physiologically absorbing nutrients or substances into your body. And because something goes into your blood, it will go to your liver. So your liver is the organ that encounters everything that you absorb. And so the liver's job is to metabolize or process things that you absorb. And so the issue, though, is that the liver can become injured owing to a response to many of these things. And some things are known that if you take too much of it, can lead to injury of the liver. So acetaminophen or Tylenol is an example of that. It's known that it is a medication that you can take that can help you feel less pain, right? A so-called analgesic, and it works. But if you take too much of it, or if you're in a place where you're trying to hurt yourself, you can take a lot of it to try to hurt yourself, and it will hurt you by hurting your liver. And so in a predictable way, it will hurt you if you take too much of it, whether purposefully or not. But there are other medications where you would have unexpectedly an adverse reaction to it. And so both of these situations, whether known or not, purposefully or not purposefully, you have a process called drug-induced liver injury. And so these things can happen, and they can happen to many drugs. And you can't tell necessarily in a given person or not whether it's going to happen. And so, you know, you can imagine then that many drugs can have this risk. And sometimes it becomes apparent, and sometimes it's not. And sometimes you catch it because you happen to check the labs, and sometimes you don't. And it can be very difficult. But the more drugs you take, the more risk you are for having it. And you know, it's a difficult phenomenon to identify. But you know, and especially in the age of supplements, and it's challenging, especially in America, whereby supplements, by virtue of being labeled as such, are not subject to any sort of regulation or quality control. At least here in America, it's not the case that you know, there's some sort of legislative regulatory body that sort of maintains quality control over these products, that you know, there could be contaminants or adulterants, or like, you know, what's claimed to be the case on the label might not be the case, that it's actually said, like, what's in there is actually in there. So there, it's hard to say. And so ultimately, you know, drug-induced liver injury, you know, for us is really difficult to parse out. But you can imagine then that, you know, like the more you take, the more you are at risk for something with the liver. And so that's why we as physicians always sort of hesitate to sort of like, you know, like be so sort of like more, because there's always a risk of something else.
Yeah, of course, that makes a lot of sense. And you spoke about this before, about the fibrosis of the liver, which is cirrhosis, and I'm pretty sure many of our listeners are familiar with that, but are there any other diseases that you would like our listeners to know about, probably to shed more light about them?
Yeah, so you know, fatty liver diseases is but one sort of class of what's called chronic liver disease, you know, diseases that cause chronic liver inflammation, which then over many years can then lead to fibrosis, which is scarring of the liver, and then severe fibrosis, which is cirrhosis. But cirrhosis is the final common pathway of any chronic liver disease. And so there's many other liver diseases which can lead to this process of fibrosis and cirrhosis. And so just to sort of name a few, there's autoimmune liver diseases. So autoimmune hepatitis is one, whereby your immune system attacks the liver cells inside your body. Similarly, you also have bile duct cells. And so these other diseases, primary biliary cholangitis, PBC, or primary sclerosing cholangitis, PSC, among others, are autoimmune diseases where your immune system attacks your bile duct cells in there. You can also have viral hepatitis, whereby you have certain viruses that either attack your liver cells themselves or cause your immune system to attack the virus, which then affects your liver cells. Hepatitis A, hepatitis B, hepatitis C, hepatitis D or Delta, hepatitis E. You can have other genetic diseases whereby your body, for one reason or another, either has buildup of normal things that it can't clear or certain metals that it can't get out of the body. So for example, Wilson disease is a disease where you can't get rid of copper from inside your body. Hemochromatosis is where you can't get rid of iron from inside your body and it builds up inside the liver. Alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency is where you get buildup of this enzyme that you can't get rid of from your body. And there's other rare ones as well, corresponding to different issues with processing metabolism, like breakdown products from your body from a biochemical standpoint. There's certain diseases of pregnancy that you can get during pregnancy. You can get certain diseases that affect your liver, the so-called HELLP syndrome, hemolysis, elevated liver test, and low platelet syndrome, HELLP syndrome, among others. And then there's certain diseases of children that one can get. Either you're born with it or you can develop during childhood, which I'll say is a separate discipline. One goes into pediatrics, pediatric gastroenterology, then pediatric hepatology as a separate pathway. And a separate discipline as well. So I'm not going to opine on that, but that's a separate sort of course of study. But pediatric liver diseases is also, so that's just kind of a taste, because there's still other diseases as well. But those are kind of the common things that we sort of think about when it comes to other diseases, and there's specialists to sort of think about that. And I'll say separately from sort of chronic liver diseases that we think about, there's sort of acute liver diseases as well, things that sort of cause sudden sort of severe liver injury as well. And then on top of that, there's things like liver cancer and liver lesions, like liver masses, which aren't cancer as well, that sort of people sort of dedicate their specialty, their focus on as well.
I see. Well, thank you. That was a lot of information. Thank you. I appreciate it. So I know in addition to being a hepatologist, you also do a little bit of research in epidemiology and are also an obesity and lifestyle medicine physician. So, and I think this is very relevant and timely. It's, what is the biggest cause of the obesity epidemic in the United States as opposed to like other developed countries like Sweden, which do not face this issue? And what do you think could probably reduce the extent of this trend?
Yeah, it's a tough question, and I certainly don't have a single answer that is the definitive answer. Certainly, there are people who are not focused on hepatology and who sort of, you know, devote their whole career to answering this question and what to do about it. Certainly from my clinical perspective and in talking with my patients, there is certainly an idea of sort of early onset obesity that has played a compelling role in the development then of adult obesity. That, you know, obesity is something that was ingrained sort of long before they saw me in the clinic. It was something that was built upon a foundation of habits that was established sort of in the distant past, and then was worsened by a variety of events in the course of one's life that are known to then sort of trigger more weight gain. And it's known that in the course of one's life, that there are certain events that lead to more weight gain, right? And so, like, for example, you know, like large transitions in one's life, like going to college or finishing some like military service or finishing an athletic career, getting married, getting divorced, having a severe, a traumatizing life event, starting a job, like losing a job, getting married, getting divorced, retiring, suffering a loss in the family, having children, retiring, etc. All these large life events are associated with weight gain that we sort of accumulate throughout our lives. But even before those events, you know, the habits that we build sort of are sort of ingrained in us long ago. And so even before talking about adult obesity, childhood obesity is already a large issue to begin with. And that has been on the rise. And so a lot of that is cultural, I'll say. And so in America, anyways, we talk about what factors then contribute to childhood obesity. And you know, a lot of that could be argued to be societal and in part cultural, at least in this country. And so you know, it's known that obesity has been on the rise over the past 50 years. And it's thought that at least some known contributory factors are culturally based. You know, in America, the incentivization of productivity at work, right? Like Americans are known to work hard, to have a relatively fast paced lifestyle, you know, to value hard work, the sort of the concept of pulling oneself up by their bootstraps, the value of a good day's work. Couple that with the need to eat fast, the processing of food as a result, preservation of food, refrigeration as a result, the relative inexpensive nature of said processed food compared to sort of more whole and natural foods, the loss of the family meal as a result of said hard work, the idea of incentivizing a given company's ability to provide food quickly and fast, and thus sort of the processing of food, making it easier to get food fast, right? And the fact that one could buy it quickly and fast and cheaply would allow one to then get food. But that tends to be the more energy dense food, and thus the food that is more likely to lead to weight gain. Like these are all factors that are thought to drive weight gain to some degree. And certainly we think about individual factors, and so at the individual level, patients I see in the clinic, you know, patients often internalize the idea of weight gain, and sort of there's self-blame that's inflicted upon oneself. I'll say myself included, you know, I'm leaner now, but I'll say as one who struggled with obesity most of his life, I'll say that there's a lot of internal sort of direction that's placed when it comes to obesity. But unfortunately, it's a larger issue than oneself. And so a lot of these are cultural and societally oriented. And so, you know, I think that in America, it's a challenge, but it isn't, you know, it isn't the case that it's isolated to America. You know, in large part, you know, it is likely to be encountered by every country in the world, at one point or another, even in countries who are currently not encountering it. If not now, then at some point in the near future.
That's very interesting. I didn't think about it that way. Thank you so much for that. It was very insightful. Well, like you mentioned, obesity is one of the leading causes of liver disease. So and I'm assuming alcohol as well. So apart from lifestyle changes, like probably working out more or not drinking or even a transplant, have you come across any research or treatments that are in the preliminary phases that could medically treat liver diseases?
Well, you know, like from a hepatology standpoint, we generally think about treating liver diseases as treating the specific liver disease to prevent progression of the disease towards fibrosis, right? So for fatty liver disease, we think about we think about treating the fat in the liver, but we think about even taking a step back and thinking about the thing that is causing the fat to build up. So if it's obesity, for example, we do think about treating obesity itself. And so for me specifically, my desired approach is sort of thinking about weight management, treating obesity, treating metabolic health. But you know, that's the specific direction I have chosen to take. Not all hepatologists choose to do that. Some might choose to treat something else. You know, the field itself is focusing on treatments to treat the inflammation from the fatty liver disease. And so there's certain medications that are being studied to treat that aspect rather than treating the obesity part. And some medications are being studied that kind of treat both. I think that one of the questions you had are wanting to think about what was Ozempic, for example, also known as semaglutide. And so that medication, for example, is one that is currently being studied for this disease, separate from weight loss. And it is effective for this disease also. And so that's one of many medications that's being studied separately for weight loss for this liver disease. For this specific disease, there are many, many medications that are being studied and are moving through the research pipeline, which would perhaps be useful. I've chosen to also, focus my clinical practice on weight management, but it's not the only approach. If it were the case, though, that the fatty liver disease is caused by alcohol, then the treatment would then, be centered perhaps on treating unhealthy alcohol use, right? Some people have the disease alcohol use disorder, and there are medications to treat alcohol use disorder, and so then the treatment could be centered on that instead of the liver itself. But still, treating alcohol use disorder would get someone to stop drinking alcohol in an unhealthy manner and would treat the liver, right, all the same. And so then the treating alcohol use disorder then could be the focus as well, which is treating the liver indirectly. But when it comes to other liver diseases, thinking about those diseases, also each of them have their own sort of pathway when it comes to thinking about treatments. So, for example, the most recent success and the largest innovation of the field of hepatology is that of viral hepatitis in this past decade, and specifically hepatitis C. Up until around 2012, when one had hepatitis C virus in particular, which was the most common viral hepatitis in America, that most people couldn't get cured. You were kind of stuck with it. It really made cirrhosis happen pretty commonly. It was the most common liver disease in the world. And if you wanted to get treated for it, you had to get weekly infusions, which had a whole slew of side effects. You had to get it weekly for a whole year. It was terrible. It was kind of the same as getting chemotherapy, basically. In the hospital, you felt terrible. It only worked maybe half the time to actually cure you. And so many people didn't, just kind of took their chances and took the risk of getting cirrhosis. But in the early 2010s, pills started being developed. And we call these direct acting antivirals. And these drugs became game changers. They were drugs that, they were pills that you can take once a day, maybe twice a day for 3 months. And they cured 95%, 98%, 100% of people as long as you took the pill, 3 months. And in some people now you can take it for 2 months. And now you have a variety of pills that you can just take, and it cures you 95% and 100% of the time. And so now Hep C, curable, just generally curable. And originally you had special populations that couldn't be cured. You had to do research on them. And now in 2023, Hep C, curable. You don't have to take any infusions or anything. And so we've effectively cured Hep C. And so this is a long way from when it was originally described in the late 1980s. Mm-hmm. We've cured Hep C effectively. And so that's the largest success in hepatology that we've had in recent years. But still Hep A, Hep B is kind of the main thing that we sort of think about. But the other diseases, still, things moving forward, autoimmune hepatitis, the other bile duct related autoimmune diseases. And then also, I mentioned sort of these diseases lead to fibrosis and then cirrhosis. There are drugs that are being researched that are called antifibrotics, drugs that say, irrespective of what's causing fibrosis, can we treat fibrosis itself? And there's no drugs that are approved, but there are people who are researching antifibrotics, like can we stop the fibrosis process? Because that's the part that actually causes harm to the liver. And so there are drugs being studied. Unfortunately, none are ready for prime time, but that's another direction of inquiry that is being studied as well. And then even on the transplantation side, you know, there are innovations that are being studied as well. So, for example, you know, the traditional model of transplant is that someone, you know, like has someone has effectively passed and their liver is given to someone else who needs it, right? A so-called deceased donor transplant. But these days, one who is healthy can donate half of their liver to someone else who needs it, right? A so-called living donor liver transplantation. And what's currently being researched is the idea of xenotransplantation, right? Where a non-human organism can donate, hopefully one day, their liver to a human donor, right? It's been done with a heart in recent years. And so the hope is that in the coming years that so we can translate such principles to the liver as well. And so that research is also currently in process. So even with liver transplantation, sort of research is being done as well. And there's a variety of other things which I won't talk about, but certainly there are a variety of things being studied that can sort of move our field forward, I will say.
Yeah, that's super fascinating, though. I did not know about the antifibrotics, so that's very interesting to know about. I'm sure an academic hepatologist such as yourself has all the information about that. And you also mentioned Ozempic, which is what I wanted to talk a little bit more about, because like you know, I'm in at the University of Southern California, which is in Los Angeles. And many of my peers and several celebrities are actually abusing this drug called semaglutide, which is Ozempic. And I feel like social media has played a really big role in influencing women and their perceptions of themselves. And I wanted to ask a hepatologist such as yourself as to why, you know, abusing medications like this is bad, so that, you know, perhaps the public is more aware about the side effects of these drugs, and are there any other treatments that are available to help people lose weight in a healthy way?
Yeah, so you know, I just like I'll say taking off my hepatology hat and putting on my obesity medicine hat for a minute, just because in my practice, like I care for patients with liver disease, but you know, a large part of my practice is helping patients with weight management, right? Like being an obesity medicine doctor means like I help patients lose weight as the treatment for fatty liver disease. And so part of that practice means routinely prescribing what we call anti-obesity medications or medications that help with weight loss. And so you know that is routine practice on my end, and probably, you know, as a person, again, a personal comment, like probably a reason I enjoy doing this as part of my practice is as one who has struggled with weight most of his life, I'll say that I probably feel like there's a personal stake in sort of helping people sort of achieve their health goals, given sort of how hard it's known it is to lose weight, to be healthy in one's life. And so I'll say that it's sort of, it's challenging, I'll say, because excess weight and obesity is a serious public health issue. It causes health related issues, fatty liver disease being one example of a weight related complication, but it is known that there are over 200 health related complications that one can get from weight that are known in the human body. But conflating that is the idea of obesity as an issue of aesthetic perception, which is a cultural issue, right? It differs from culture to culture and individual to individual within cultures. And so, you know, I will not speak to that. That is not my place to speak of. I have no authority on that. I am not a cultural anthropologist. But obesity is a serious public health issue. Like I have to some degree some experience with that, I guess I can say. And so that being said, thinking about then for patients with health issues in whom weight loss would be a helpful treatment, one could think about the different treatments that could be available in order to help a patient improve their health through losing weight. And when we say losing weight, we're talking about reduction in fat mass, right? So we talk about losing weight is reduction in fat mass. We use the word weight because we use body weight, the number, to try to indirectly quantify the amount of fat we have on our bodies. It's hard to give a single number that tells us how much fat we have on our bodies. There's ways to do it, but it's just hard to measure that in the clinic. So we just say body weight. It tends to be a good enough number, but that's why we use that number. But what we're actually trying to say is reduce the amount of fat on our bodies, because the fat on our bodies causes us health issues.
Mm-hmm.
And so then when we talk about fat mass reduction or weight loss, we think about medical treatments then for weight loss. And so, you know, the general public, we tend to sort of focus on lifestyle modifications as the first step, right? So we talk about dietary habits changes, and then we talk about physical activity, exercise being one example of a physical activity, right? And so we don't need to talk about details about those changes, but those changes are the foundation of which we talk about a healthy lifestyle, right? We talk about eating healthier and then eating sort of less energy dense foods, less calories. And we talk about sort of sustainability, like foods that aren't energy dense, that don't have a lot of calories, that have good nutrients in it, and that keeping those healthy habits up for the long term, right? And then having good exercise habits so that you have good muscle, a good amount of muscle, so that the muscle burns more calories normally than the rest of the tissues in your body, so that you burn a good amount of calories normally, so that even if you ate more, you still burn more calories normally. That's sort of the foundation that you build upon. But it's known that lifestyle modification, like research has found that lifestyle modification, if you try to leverage that alone for weight loss, it's hard. You know, it's been found that one generally, if we talk about, if someone weighs 200 pounds and you say how much weight on average you expect someone to lose, if you sent them with lifestyle modifications as a recommendation, how much weight you would expect them to lose as a percent, on average, you would expect them to lose 3 to 5% of their body weight. And that basically amounts to 7 to 10 pounds. If someone weighs 200 pounds to start with, on average, that's how much you would expect them to lose based on research. And so that's a little bit, you know, it tends to be less than most people would desire to lose weight, but on average, that's how much you would expect. And so then, you know, enter sort of medical treatments that we can think about when it comes to things that we can do to help people lose weight. And I'll say that, you know, these are things that have been researched. And, you know, I won't spend so much time in detail, but just know that, you know, like from an obesity medicine, like physician standpoint, like these are things that we can think about, that they've been researched, and like there's sort of regulations and things that sort of like lead to approval. So Ozempic, for example, is an example of what we call an obesity, an anti-obesity medication. And it's approved. It's approved by the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, in the appropriate circumstances to help with weight loss. And these medications help by reducing appetite. And there's other ones that are approved. And in the right person, they can help with reducing appetite to help with weight loss. And so using it in the right person, in the right circumstance, could be a useful tool. And other medications could be considered also. But in other people, it might be the case that a medical nutrition program or a meal replacement program might be useful. It might be the case that certain endoscopic procedure, there's so-called, you know, bariatric endoscopy, could be useful. And then in other people, bariatric surgery could be the right procedure. But each of them have their pros and cons. Each of them have their expected amount of weight loss. Each of them have their reasons to consider it, reasons not to consider it. And each of them should be sort of considered thoughtfully in the right person, because certain people should consider these things. Certain people should not consider these things. Certain people should be considered risky. And everyone should be considered sort of the right people who are doing it for the right reason. And I'll say that, you know, when we talk about things like aesthetics and social media, like, unfortunately, in this age of technology and comparativism, I'll say that, like, that's never a right reason to do such things. I'll say
I
it's
agree.
really about, from my perspective, it's really about health and well-being.
Of course. Thank you so much. And that wraps up all the questions I've had for today. And I just wanted to thank you so much for your time and effort.
Of course, I'm happy to talk.
Thank you so much.